You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
So this podcast episode is all about house hacking around Denver. Now, the format in this episode is different from the ones that we've done so far. Rather than being one interview, it's actually a series of short interviews. The first one is Charles Roberts and I discussing the basics of house hacking. Then the next interview is with a local lender to discuss financing options. And the final interview segment is with a local property manager. So this episode actually kicks off a new series that dives into house hacking. We'll have some future episodes that feature house hackers who have used it to launch their successful investing careers. Also, we just published a house hacking e-guide on our website. It's a detailed guide that'll be updated with future content and case studies. Check it out at denverinvestmentrealestate.com/househack. All right, so let's move on with the episode. Enjoy. So I'm sitting here with Charles Roberts to talk about house hacking in Denver. And just some quick background on Charles. He's been a realtor since 2004, and currently he's the president of Yearcastle Real Estate, which has over 500 agents. And he's actually done over 400 transactions in his time as a realtor, with the vast majority of those being investor-focused, and some of those being helping clients do some house hacking. So Charles, welcome.
Thanks, Chris. Glad to be here.
So let's just start off with the basics. Like, you know, in a few sentences, what is house hacking?
So house hacking is a term that was brought up to do unconventional real estate investing. That's about the best way I can say it. So conventional would be buy a duplex and rent it out, or buy a condo, rent it out. House hacking is all sorts of other things. Like maybe you buy a house that's a 3-bedroom, 2-bath and you rent out one of the rooms and make an extra $500. Or maybe you buy a condo or townhouse and do the same thing. Or let's say you buy a ranch and it has an unfinished basement. Maybe you add value to your property, finish it out, and actually put a kitchen in the basement and, you know, ideally put in egress windows so that it's legal, and rent that out. Lots and lots of unconventional things. And one of the number one ways to do it is the whole short-term rental, VRBO type of stuff. So it encompasses a very wide range of ways you can make money in real estate. And I'll tell you, by the time people hear this, there might be a few other things.
But in kind of some of the big differences here, this is house hacking is where the owner, it's owner occupied, right? The person's living in their house or condo or duplex or whatever and renting out the bedrooms the other side.
Yeah. And a big advantage of that is going to be the financing, of course. So for example, if you buy a house as a rental, you're going to probably have to put a minimum of 20% down. If you buy it as an owner occupied, you could do FHA, 3.5% down, maybe 5% conventional. So it allows someone who wants to be an investor a way to do it unconventionally, perhaps by getting better financing at better terms, perhaps living there as well and renting out a portion of it. So that the idea is that you maybe live for free and actually build equity in a really, really interesting way.
And so you already listed off a bunch of examples on some house hacking examples. Let's go through a few more just to kind of to make sure we touch base on them also. I know here in Denver, getting a house with a carriage house or an ADU, accessory dwelling unit, is a popular way as well, right?
A very popular way to do it, but it's getting tougher and tougher because the whole short-term rental VRBO type of thing, it is so profitable that people who own these homes that have legal, say, second units called accessory dwelling units, you can make a lot of money. So people have been coming in bidding these properties up because they tend to be in parts of town that are walkable, older parts of town, really desirable areas, expensive, but with the ability to actually make money from the short-term rentals. So yeah, it's popular, but it's you've got to find the right property to make sense.
And I can just, before we jump into more details, you know, I'm 35 now, and I wish I knew about this concept of house hacking when I was, you know, 22 getting out of college, because as you learn more about it and get in the numbers, it is just a phenomenal way to kind of get started in real estate investing. And you can really build up a great portfolio if you're willing to, you know, there's some sacrifices and pros and cons, which we'll talk about. But Charles, just to kind of, I think the best starting point here is, let's do a quick role play. Let's say I'm a potential client. and I'm interested in real estate investing, but I don't have the money to put 20 or 25% down on the condo, but I want to do something. I've got some money saved. I want to house hack to start my portfolio. I call you up. We get together for coffee. Where would we even start in learning about what would work for me? You know, where would you start with me?
So I'd ask you a bunch of questions, like, what are you looking to do? So let's just kind of do a quick role play. You can be you or another person. But I would say, okay, Chris, that sounds great. You know, there's lots and lots of possibilities here. Tell me in five sentences, what are you looking to do?
Well, going backwards for a minute, I'm in my mid-20s. I want to start building, you know, wealth and long-term retirement. And I want to buy a house and ideally, I want to live for free for a few years and then move out, keep it as a pure rental, then, you know, buy a nice house for myself or do it over again.
Okay. So it's actually fairly doable. So first thing we have to talk about is your finance ability. You know, do you have 2 years of tax returns? Do you have a job, et cetera? Can you actually? Because trying to combine, you know, like hard money and this and that with, you know, house hacking, it gets very complicated and it's probably not going to work. So the first thing is, can you buy a property? Let's hope the answer is yes, you can finance a property. From there, it's not that difficult. I mean, let's say you bought a townhome, a 3-bedroom, 2-bath townhome. I can show you the numbers in reasonable parts of town, certainly not the worst part of town, but maybe not the best part of town, where you could just about live for free putting 5% down. You could buy a townhome for, you know, $210,000, put 5% down, get a couple of your buddies to pay, you know, $600, $650, $700 a unit, something, you know, for one of the bedrooms, something like that. And the numbers are really phenomenal for you to do this. Of course, if you're willing to maybe live with your buddies or live with people off Craigslist, and that I know we're going to get into a lot more.
So right there is a pro and a con. So a pro is I'm living for free or making a few hundred dollars, but the con is I got roommates and also kind of a landlord. I have to make sure people are paying me rent, right?
Yeah, not kind of a landlord. You are a landlord.
But that's probably one of the issues people get into. It's viewed as a hobby or not a business so far, and does that throw a wrench into things for people?
It can. Of course, it comes down to very specifics. What's your situation? But it's kind of like a funnel. It's like lots and lots of people want to do it. But the more they think about, oh, God, that I'm going to have to collect rent from my friend. I don't want to do that. Then maybe you don't do house hacking, right? That's the con. But the pros are so powerful. There is so much that can be done. It is such a great way to get into real estate and real estate investing that only you, the listener, can decide if it's right for you, but it's certainly doable.
Now, do you have like a general recommended house or style of house for someone to buy, a triplex, a mother-in-law suite, a carriage house, or does it all just depend on the client, the amount of money, and how they want to live?
100% the latter. Completely depends. There's no perfect rule of thumb here. What I can tell you, for example, is that in our market today, duplexes are very, very expensive. Whereas 5 or 6 years ago, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, the, you know, I'm doing finger quotes, house hacking, because the term wasn't used back then, for a duplex was pretty doable because they were pretty inexpensive. Now they've gotten very expensive and we're seeing fewer people able to really make it work. It can work, but we're seeing more towards buying a house, 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 4-bedroom, something like that, and renting out a room or two or a condo or townhome tends to be better cash flow. But it just completely comes down to what you want. You might say, no, I don't want to live in the same unit with my tenants. That's crazy. I'll buy a triplex. Great. And then we'll go through the numbers. And it's entirely possible that your monthly cash flow will be lower with a typical triplex than a typical townhome. But you might say, okay, I'll make $220 less with the triplex, but I've got my own place, right? It comes down to you.
So it's kind of got to balance the investing with personal happiness requirements?
Yes. Yeah. You know, and that's the thing that I think people who sometimes don't think that through, they'll come to me and they'll say, this is what I want to do. And I'll slow them down a little bit. And I'm like, okay, are you good with this? Does your husband want to do this? Does your wife? Does your boyfriend? Like, do you live with someone? Like, have you guys thought this through? And it really needs to be thought through. And I think that's the whole point of this podcast.
And let's dive into that. Because as I talked to you the last few months about this, you've said a lot of times you've had, you know, a couple come with you and one person's very eager and just loves the idea of house hacking because it's a phenomenal way to get investing. But then their spouse or partner or boyfriend or girlfriend is on the opposite end of the spectrum. Like, how do you handle that? What recommendations do you have if someone's out there, you know, married or got a significant other?
And I'll tell you, I'm going to be honest. 100% of the time, it's the guy who comes to me with a great plan. And then I explain, okay, you know, are you married? Yeah, yeah, my wife's on board. Are you sure? Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. And then we'll look at a few places where the cash flow could make sense. And very often, it's the spouse who says, that's great. You can live here, Mr. Husband, but you're not living here with me. I've seen this over and over again. And, you know, it has to work in a number of different ways. But yeah, if you are married, then you pretty much both have to sign off on this, or it's just not worth it.
And something else that because I'm moving to Denver, and a lot of my time is out here coming to Denver. I've stayed in Airbnbs, and you know, I've talked to the owners of the properties, kind of getting a feel for the numbers, how they like it, just because I'm truly intrigued by it. And the last time I stayed out here, I rented out a private bedroom with a shared bathroom. It was like $29 a night. And it was a nice part of town in Arvada, just the suburbs, nice, you know, family homes. And I talked to the owner, the landlord, about the numbers, you know, because he has like a 4 or 5 bedroom place, big house, and he rents out 3 bedroom short term, 1 to long term. And he goes, yeah, even renting out to you $30 a night short term, I make so much more money that way than I would doing a long-term rental.
Yeah. I mean, that's awesome. That's good. That is great. I mean, just do the math. I mean, yeah. That is so cheap. You come to Denver, you know, a Motel 6 is going to cost you $60-$80. I don't even know what it is. You can rent a nice house in a nice part of Old Town Arvada or someplace like that for $30. And the guy is making money. I mean, this is why you're listening to the podcast and why we're talking about it, because it is a very, very realistic way of potentially living for free and building equity in real estate.
So, for the listener out there who's interested in this, like, is there like, do you have like a 1-2-3-step process on how they should start, you know, kind of figuring things out? Should they start looking at properties? Should they hop on Zillow? Should they talk to you, talk to a loan officer? Kind of want to be a general, I know it's hard to give a general blanket guideline.
So I think it's, you start with someone who understands this, probably a real estate professional or a friend, someone who's done this kind of thing. And you have this exact discussion. Very early on, you want to talk to a loan officer, make sure you're qualified. Maybe you can buy a $160,000 condo, but you can't buy a $275,000 house. So the loan picture should come in very early. And then right after that, you start looking at properties. You start because you're going to live there. And it's, you know, Zillow's great and, you know, you can go look at pictures and stuff, but just, let's not kid ourselves. You're going to live there. It's important that you be comfortable, and you may have, you know, very low requirements for where you want to live. Terrific. But you may have high requirements, and you're going to find out quickly that you're not going to want to live in certain parts of town. So maybe you go to different parts of town. My feeling is the numbers will be lower. The income will be lower for you in the nicer parts of town, but you know what? It might be marginally lower. There is no substitute for going and looking at properties. That's basically what you want to do. Begin to get an idea of what this all starts with. Talk to a loan officer, make sure you can do it, and then go start looking at properties and just do basic spreadsheet calculations. Basic. Type in 3 or 4 numbers, you get the result, you go, okay, that makes sense, or maybe it doesn't.
And also, I mean, something I've done, like if you are looking at this, you know, you don't have to overcomplicate the process. If you know some areas, hop on Craigslist and see what a bedroom rents out for long term. Then hop on Airbnb.com and see what similar looking properties are renting out for on a daily or weekly basis. And you can very quickly get the rents and also do a quick analysis of, hey, I can rent out a bedroom for, I'll say, $600 a month, or Airbnb now at $40 a night. And if I have 20 nights renting out, I'll make this amount of money. I mean, it's really that simple, right?
The math isn't overly complicated. No, it's really, really not. Anybody can do that.
So, I mean, I know a lot of this sounds like it just kind of depends on a lot of the personal situation. Are there any other tips or recommendations you have, Charles, for someone who's looking at this?
One of the things to look at are what the laws are. In Denver, fairly recently, they put their foot down and said, okay, if you're going to do short-term rentals, it has to be an owner-occupied property in almost all areas of Denver. So that means you can't buy a place on 123 Main Street, not live there, and rent it out short-term. You have to actually live there. And more they are actually doing research and catching people, because there's hundreds, if not thousands, of these short-term VRBOs going on in Denver of investors. I actually have an investor buddy of mine who has 15 of them. He's making unbelievable amounts of money. He has beautiful properties, beautifully fixed up, doing short-term rentals. He's obviously not living in all of them. And in one neighborhood, he got caught and he had to sell the property. He got turned into the city. So that is a risk you have to take. I certainly wouldn't recommend, you know, breaking the law and taking that risk. And then you might ask, well, what about Westminster? What about Arvada? What about Aurora? Every city is different, and they're all a little behind Denver right now because they wanted to kind of see what the big animal did. And they're actually very much in the process of deciding how they want to handle this. So that is part of the process if you're looking at doing something that may or may not be allowed. Otherwise, if you just basically, you know, have a rental, have an owner-occupied property and rent out portions of it, that becomes much simpler legally.
Okay, great. And as we wrap up, if people have questions, what's the best way for them to reach you?
Feel free to email me. It's C Roberts, the letter C, Roberts, as in Sam, @yourcastle.org. Or you can always drop me a line or text 303-523-3837.
Great. Well, thank you, Charles. And, you know, going on the website, denverinvestmentrealestate.com, we'll be having a lot more segments and topics and hopefully some case studies about house hacking. So if you have questions, please reach out to us. Please visit the website and explore the resources there.
Hi, this is Charles Roberts. I have in the studio today Joe Massey. Joe is a lender and colleague and friend, and we were talking about house hacking and the benefits of doing it and how lending can fit in. So I asked him to come in and talk a little bit about different sorts of house hacking that he has seen over time and how the lending works with it, what the advantages are, if there are any disadvantages, and what he has seen work for his investors. So I'm going to turn it over to Joe, ask him a few questions. But Joe, do a quick introduction and let's talk about this.
Hey, Charles, thanks so much for having me in the studio today. Always great to see you. Talking a little bit about house hacking, this is a topic that we hear a lot about. Lots of folks have questions on it, so hopefully we'll have some good ideas for you. There's several different ways to do it. We're going to talk a little bit about the financing options, some of the ways my investors have done it. And then a little background on myself. I am a lender with Castle & Cook Mortgage. We're a direct mortgage lender, so we work with lots of investors, lots of folks financing their primary residence. Lots of people getting a primary residence and then renting it out, you know, renting a portion of it while they're living there and basically doing this house hacking strategy. So we're going to talk about that today. First topic I want to talk about is what is house hacking? We see this a lot on the website and lots of different places. And essentially, the definition of house hacking is simply buying a primary residence, living there, and also receiving rental income from it. There's a number of different ways to do it, but it's important to understand that it is your primary residence and you have to live there in order to get primary residence financing. So people contact me a lot of times and say, oh my gosh, Joe, I saw this great program for $1,000 down and I want to use that to buy an investment property. Well, no, you know, the $1,000 down or 3% or 3.5% down, those are for your primary residence. So if you want to use a program like that, you're going to have to live in the property. But then you have the option to rent out other areas of the property that you're not living in. So let's talk about a sample scenario with an accessory dwelling unit. These are common in Lakewood and West Denver. We'll see the main house, you know, 1,800 square feet. And then behind it, there might be a converted carriage house, which now has a mother-in-law suite or some other sort of living space. And you can buy that property with a normal FHA loan of 3.5% down or a conventional loan of 3% down for first-time home buyers or 5% down for anybody who's not a first-time home buyer. With your 3.5%, 3%, or 5% down, we finance that property as a standard primary residence. You move into that home, clean it up, and you're living there with you and your spouse and your children. And then you have the option to rent out that accessory dwelling unit. So a lot of times those accessory dwelling units are usually one bed, one bath, maybe 500 or 600 square feet, but those can rent for as much as $700 or $800 in West Denver is where we see a lot of these. So that's something that, you know, depending on the price point, maybe the payment for your mortgage is $2,000 a month, but you can rent out that accessory dwelling unit for $800 a month. Now your mortgage payment's actually only $1,200 a month net. So that's something I've seen a lot of my clients do in the past.
Is there an issue with appraisals on the ADU, on the back unit? Is there, how do appraisers value the back unit versus the front unit?
Have you ever seen any?
So that can be a problem where a person would actually say, well, that back unit is worth X dollars as a, you know, to put my mother-in-law there or mm-hmm. to maybe make money. But have you seen appraisal issues? It sounds like appraisers aren't valuing it the same as the square footage in the main house.
Yeah, it's not nearly as valuable. Generally, the positive adjustment I'll see for an accessory dwelling unit range between $10,000 and $30,000. So it's not a huge value add from an appraisal standpoint, but it can be a good value add that, hey, if I've got to pay $40,000 or $50,000 extra to get this property that has an accessory dwelling unit and I can make $800 a month off of that, that can be a very valuable piece of the property for the buyer, but it's not valuable for the lender from an appraisal standpoint.
Okay, so that's something to keep in mind if you are looking to invest in something like this to make sure you understand the subtleties, which might be the appraisal issue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So another great house hacking strategy is renting out a basement. I see this a lot where a lot of times all over Denver, Highlands Ranch, Aurora, all over the city, there are properties that have, you know, two bed, two bath upstairs and then a basement with one bed, one bath. Sometimes there's a separate entrance. Other times there's not. It just depends. But that can be a great way, especially for younger buyers who are comfortable sharing space. They can buy a property and then rent out the basement, you know, one bed, one bath. Basement with, you know, 600 or 700 square feet, you could probably rent for $700 to $800 a month, I would imagine. Maybe less, maybe more, just depends on the area. But again, let's say you have a $2,000 a month payment. If I could rent that basement, let's just say $600 a month, my house payment would now just be a net of $1,400 a month. That's cheaper than renting just about anywhere in the city. So that's a great strategy as well. Have you seen clients do that, Charles?
Yeah, I have. And I love it when clients want to do that to rent. We see, for example, people will go to a multi-unit next where people maybe get a duplex or a triplex. But the problem with those we're going to talk about is that they're very expensive as opposed to, for example, buying a ranch in a part of town where they're not overly expensive and potentially putting a legal bedroom in the basement if there's a basement with 8-foot ceilings and such and doing it to code and doing it to correctly. But yes, we have seen people do that and the numbers are fantastic. Frankly, the numbers are far and away better in this type of situation than I've seen people trying to buy duplexes to fourplexes the last few years. It's been tough. We'll get to that, but
yep,
that's hard.
Now, an important distinction on the ADUs and basement rentals is when you're qualifying for this new loan, we're not going to give you credit for any of that rental income because this is your primary residence. If you want to have a tenant there, you certainly can, but you're going to need to qualify for this loan. Let's just say it's a $300,000 property and you're putting 5% down, you're going to need to qualify for that $285,000 loan just based on your existing income. We're not going to give you credit for any of that rental income for that accessory dwelling unit or that basement. Now, in the future, when you go to refinance or buy a new property, as long as that rental income has been reported on your tax returns, at that point, we'll give you credit for that rental income. But when you're buying that property new, and you don't have any history of rental income, we're not going to give you any credit for that.
Can I ask you a question?
So sure.
It has to be on your tax returns, you said, to get credit. So
correct.
For those of you who aren't going to do that, if that's what you choose to do, just understand, kind of hard to have your cake and eat it too.
Yep. One of my favorite things is people constantly talk about how they don't want to pay taxes, they don't want to declare their income, and I make a ton of money, but I just don't show that I have a ton of money. Well, whatever you show, quote unquote, to the IRS is what we believe. Because that is, you know, truly the information that you're disclosing.
And this would be a great time to tell you to consult your CPA and your attorney.
Of course. Now, another option for house hacking is renting out a room, or maybe two rooms. I've had folks do this where, younger clients oftentimes are not married yet, no kids. They will purchase a property, maybe a three bed, three bath home or three bed, two bath. They'll live in the master suite and then they'll rent out the other two extra rooms to their roommates. Now, these were the roommates that they had, you know, last month, but they were all renting a place. Now, one of them is taking the initiative to buy the property and rent out those two extra rooms to the roommates that he already had. And they know they're going to get along and everybody's happy. Same thing. Let's say you have a $2,000 a month payment. If I can rent each room for $500 a month, now my net payment is only $1,000 a month. So that's a great strategy as well. You know, again, we're not going to give you credit for that rental income because it is more of an informal arrangement. But once you're reporting that income on your tax returns, we would be able to use that in the future. Another really popular strategy is Airbnb or VRBO rentals. I actually participated in a panel discussion a few weeks ago from some folks that are experts on Airbnb rentals. And one of the folks there has actually put in some custom walls and custom adjustments in her home that they rent out half of their property as an Airbnb. So they have kind of a, I think it's a sliding wall is what you would call it, that when they're home and they don't have a rental in place, they open up these walls and they have access to the entire property, the kitchen, all three of the bathroom or all three of the bedrooms, both of the bathrooms, etc. And then when they get an Airbnb rental, they pull open these sliding walls, and that closes off one of the bathrooms and one of the bedrooms. And there's a separate entrance from the back door, and that's where she and her husband stay. And then the other half of the house is the two bedrooms, bathroom, and the kitchen, and that's where the short-term renters get to stay. And then they rent it out for as much as $200 to $300 per night. So they're not renting it out 30 nights a month, but they are renting it anywhere from 15 to 25 nights a month and making a very significant income on that. Now, the part about that that's important to remember is it's inconvenient. When they're doing that, they don't have access to the kitchen because you can't be going in and out of your short-term renter's space. So they eat out a lot.
Well, they can, I suppose. Right?
I guess you could.
Yeah. It just depends on what you want to do, what the agreement is. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. In this particular case, she has an agreement that they get exclusive use.
Got it.
But yeah, I suppose you could write up your agreement to go in and out of the kitchen. But that's been a tremendous strategy for her. She has regular primary residence financing on that property. They did the renovations to add that sliding wall after they closed. Again, we're not going to give you credit for any of that Airbnb income because it's not a long-term lease when you're first looking to apply for that loan. And really, you'd still need to be living in the property, so we're not going to give you credit for rental income on a property that you're living in.
Question. So let's say I buy an Airbnb. I do it legally. I'm in the city or county of Denver. I register. I pay my taxes. I do everything right. I make money. I declare that money. I have income for 2 years. I have tax returns showing I made $12,000 for 2 years. If I want to do a refinance, is that in any way included?
Yeah. At that point, once you've declared it on your tax returns, yes, we're absolutely going to use it.
Cool.
But it's when it's brand new income and, you know, you don't have a long-term lease. No, we're not going to be giving you credit for that.
Great.
So the last one, which I think, you know, the four we spoke about could work with a single family residence or even a condo renting out a room. The last one, though, is going to be more of a unique property type, and this is going to be a multi-unit. Purchasing a duplex, triplex, or fourplex, living in one unit and renting out the other one, two, or three units. Charles and I have several colleagues who have done this and made literally hundreds of thousands of dollars from this strategy. One really good example, I had a client purchase a duplex over in Lakewood back in 2012. We did FHA financing, 3.5% down. He lived in one unit, rented out the other side. At the time we closed on the transaction, his payment was about $1,400 a month. He rented out the opposite side for, I think, $1,050 per month. So he had a payment on his side of only $350. He lived there for 2 years. And then eventually moved in with his new wife, and they bought a property together. He kept that duplex, and values continued to increase. About a year ago, we actually did an investment property refinance to take cash out of that duplex. We took out more than $150,000 cash out of that property, and he used that $150,000 to buy three additional properties. So just by being disciplined and having the guts to live with his tenant for a couple of years, he made several hundred thousand dollars from that property and leveraged that to buy more properties. So that can be a really, really great strategy.
So earlier I talked about it being tough because multi-units have gotten so expensive. And the truth is, it's really important to understand the context. It used to be, quite frankly, easier. Yep. Because multi-units were cheaper and the numbers made more sense. But once again, context, it is still a phenomenal way to get into real estate. Why? Because you can buy a multi-unit. And what are you putting down again?
3.5% for FHA, or if you do conventional, it is 20% down.
Okay. So you can get into these duplexes to fourplexes for 3.5% down, live there. And even with today's numbers, you can oftentimes live for just about free. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to give you different ways of doing it. Maybe you don't want to have somebody living, you know, in the room right next door to you. So you want to have a multi-unit, or you don't want to have somebody in the basement. What's important is to understand there's no perfect strategy. That is a fallacy, that if you are just so smart and you put all your information into a computer, you'll find the perfect strategy. That is a perfect way to lose in this business. What you have to understand is you got to figure out what is right for you, if anything. That's the subtlety, and that's what we see all the time differentiate our successful clients from people who don't make it in the business. Oftentimes, people are sort of single-minded, and they say, if I just think hard enough, I'll figure it out, and I'll know the perfect thing to do. But you know what? The perfect thing for me might be different than the perfect thing for Joe. And by the way, we talk about this all the time, because we have slightly different investing strategies with what we do. So my piece of advice to you, anybody listening, especially if you're newer, is to listen to podcasts like this, but work on yourself and figure out what's going to be right for you for the long term. And if you figure that out, there is just no better way to build wealth than investing in real estate.
I agree. I mean, buying property, holding it for the long term, you know, Charles and I can speak from experience that that's a great way to build wealth, but don't take our word for it. Look around. Do your research on the internet. You'll see that real estate investing is the number one way to build wealth in the United States, whether that's investing in your primary residence, investing in multi-units, investing in investment properties. Owning and holding property is the number one way to become wealthy in the United States. And it's really not that complicated. Buy a property, put your down payment down, and hold it for a long period of time, and you're going to retire wealthy.
Great. Joe, give us your contact information if someone wants to reach out to you.
Yeah, feel free to call me anytime. My number is 303-809-7769. You can, of course, email me at jmassey@castlecookmortgage.com. And then my email information will be posted down below. Would love to chat with you. We are licensed anywhere in the state of Colorado. My company is licensed in about 35 different states, but Colorado is the only place that I personally do business. So if there's anything we can do to help you, would love to chat with you about your primary residence, purchase, refinance, your investment properties, purchasing or refinancing, or, you know, talking about doing some house hacking. You want to buy a property, multi-unit, and rent out the other side. We have programs for that. All the different scenarios we spoke about today is things that we can help you with.
Thanks very much for listening. We'll catch you on the next podcast. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. This is Charles Roberts. I have Mark Cunningham in the studio. And Mark is just a great property manager and an investor. He's been doing this for a long time. And this is part of our series on house hacking, something that's become very in vogue the last few years and something, frankly, we've been doing for decades. It now just has a name called house hacking. So the idea is I brought Mark in to talk a little bit as a professional property manager for us to understand, is there any difference in terms of managing property if, for example, you buy a duplex and live in one unit and have the other tenants live in the second unit? Or maybe you buy a house that has three bedrooms and you rent out the other two bedrooms to your friends. Or maybe you buy a ranch and finish the basement and you have someone who you're not related to in any way rent out the basement. So I really didn't give him any time to prepare. I just know he knows this stuff. And I said, talk to us as if, you know, you're talking to me, who is frankly pretty ignorant on any different strategies or any different risks or rewards from the property management perspective of house hacking. So let me turn it over to you.
Well, thank you, Charles, for having me here. It's an interesting question. And there are a lot of nuances that really come into play around that concept of house hacking, because house hacking can mean different things, as you just said, Charles. It could mean having somebody in your basement. It could mean you're in one half of a duplex and they're in the other half. And the laws and the rules and the practical day-to-day governing those things are very, very different. So let's look at that concept of you buy a duplex and you're in one half and you're renting out the other half. In that case, you need to be sure that you are following the rules, the laws of your state as it relates to landlording, as it relates to fair housing, because the way the law is going to look at you as if you are a big time investor, whether you own one property or multiple properties, the law is going to look at you the same from that standpoint. So, for example, fair housing. If you're renting out one half, the other half of a duplex, do you even know what the 7 federally protected classes are? You should, because the government certainly does and HUD certainly does. and your prospective applicant certainly may. So what that means is this is going to be your next door neighbor, and you probably have in mind in the back of your head the type of person you think you want as your next door neighbor. And there are some types of people you may not want as your next door neighbor, but to some extent that's irrelevant as it relates to fair housing. So you can't say, well, gosh, I was really hoping for a, you know, if you're a woman, I was really hoping for another female, and I really wanted her to be about my same age and kind of my same nationality and my same religious affiliation. That's going to get you in trouble. So let me pick on my mother-in-law here for a moment, because she's a great woman. But she lives in Iowa, and she's a little bit older, and she's obviously a woman, and she's Dutch, and she's a conservative Christian woman. So if she's going to be bringing in a roommate, she's going to be looking for a Dutch Christian woman who is very similar to her. And actually, if she's renting out the basement, she could do that. So here's one of the nuances of the federal fair housing laws that relates to HUD. It's commonly referred to as Mrs. Murphy's exemption. Mrs. Murphy's exemption. And the concept is this. HUD understands that, gosh, well, what if Mark's mother-in-law living in Iowa wants to rent out her basement? Are we really going to make her take somebody that is antithetical to her? She wants a roommate like her. So are we going to apply the same standards of fair housing to her as we are going to Charles, who owns a number of properties? And they say, no, we won't apply those to her. Now, there are some specific applications around that. For example, you cannot be a practitioner of real estate. So if you're a licensed real estate agent, doesn't apply. Mrs. Murphy's exemption doesn't apply. If you own multiple properties, doesn't apply. There's like five specific rules. You need to look into this. We don't have time to go into all those. But the concept is a roommate situation. That's the idea. If you want to bring a roommate in, you can be a little bit picky and choosy. One of the other rules around that is that you cannot market or advertise with any discriminatory language. So my little mother-in-law in Iowa can't put an ad in a local paper saying, I'm looking for a Dutch woman roommate.
So this is fascinating. My mouth is open because I didn't know this. So is it kind of fair to say if they're under literally the same roof, if they're the next bedroom over, if they're in a finished basement, or you stick your mother-in-law in the attic, it's okay from a fair housing perspective. But if it's a duplex, and let's just call it side by side, then you're fully under fair housing.
Correct. Huh. They have regulations around the number of units in a house. It has to be, you have to be residing in the house. You can't own certain many houses. So check into this. Don't take my word for this. Right. If you're going to do this, go into, go on the HUD website, download and search Mrs. Murphy's exemption. But that exemption is out there. It's not commonly used. I think for HUD, it's kind of a don't ask, don't tell type of a thing. But again, keep in mind, you can't even advertise. You cannot even advertise in that situation. So it's really the concept of, hey, I want a roommate, and no, I'm not going to let you be my roommate because I don't like this particular thing about you. HUD says, that's fine. We're going to let you get who you want in there. But again, if you're a real estate practitioner, you own multiple properties, does not apply. It also doesn't apply if someone hires you as a real estate property manager or real estate realtor to find them a tenant. So if my mother-in-law tells me to go find her a tenant, I can't discriminate based upon the fact that she has Mrs. Murphy's exemption.
But you could bring her people and she could still discriminate.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Because if I bring them to her, then potentially they'd have a claim against me as to why she said no to them. So if you're in the real estate world, don't think that you're going to be able to use this as a way of discriminating against folks.
Okay. Now I'm going to bet like 99% of people who are thinking about doing house hacking or even doing it didn't know this, because I'd never heard of that. And that is great, great information. Anything else that you would advise folks besides that distinction?
If you're going to be bringing somebody in, how are you going to treat that from the legal standpoint? So are you going to, if you bring a roommate in, are you going to have them sign a lease? Is it a handshake deal? How is that going to work? And I would recommend you use a lease agreement. Have an attorney draw it up. Don't just go find a free one on the internet to download, because it won't get you very far. And you don't need a lease until you need a lease. So you think you're bringing your buddy in and they're going to be your roommate and everything's going to be going great. Well, things happen and life circumstances change. So you want to document that on the front end, have a solid lease in place. It's a business transaction. You need to approach it as a business transaction. And the person you're bringing in, even if they're your friend, your buddy, they're going to understand that. They better understand it. If they don't bring them in. That, hey, you know, you're going to be paying me X number of dollars per month in rent. So we're going to have this legal agreement defining how this relationship is going to work, and treat it like a business. That's the one of the problems we see. We're often, very often, hired by individuals, and they'll call us and say, I have this house and I want you to take over management. And the situation is we rented it out to, and it'll be a friend, a relative, children. You know, we've had this instance. And now they're either not paying me rent or they're just being difficult and I can't handle it anymore. So we need you guys to come clean up the mess. And we'll say, okay, well, what documentation do you have? Well, we don't have anything. We have no lease. We have nothing. It's a handshake deal. Don't put yourself in a position for that to potentially happen to you. So get some type of a lease agreement in place, whether they're going to be a roommate in your house or especially if they're going to be on the other side of a duplex.
So we learn something new every day. Thanks, Mark. Give out your contact information if people have questions, if they can reach out to you.
So Grace Property Management is my management company. Our website is RentGrace, R-E-N-T-G-R-A-C-E, RentGrace.com. Be happy to provide information if people have questions.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Hey, Chris here again. If house hacking is on your radar, make sure you catch our next episode. It features Travis Burr, who successfully launched his investing career with a triplex house hack in Aurora. So he bought this property in 2010 at 26 years old. Now he's a full-time real estate investor. So that's on tap for the next episode. And again, make sure you check out the house hacking e-guide at denverinvestmentrealestate.com/househack. Thanks for listening. And this is Chris Lopez signing off until next time.